Welcome to Short Happy Life, a weekly half-hour reading of a short story. This evening we present the first part of Arm, from The Long Arm of Gail Hamilton, by Larry Niven. The Arm building had been abnormally quiet for some months now. We'd needed the rest, at first. But these last few mornings the silence had an edgy quality. We waved at each other on our paths to our respective desks, but our heads were elsewhere. Some of us had a restless look. Others were visibly, determinedly busy. Nobody wanted to join a mother hunt. This past year we'd managed to cut deep into the organ-legging activities in the West Coast area. Pats on the back all round, but the results were predictable. Other activities were going to increase. Sooner or later, the newspapers would start screaming about stricter enforcement of the fertility laws, and then we'd all be out hunting down illegitimate parents. All of us who were not involved in something else. It was high time I got involved in something else. This morning I walked into my office through the usual edgy silence. I ran coffee from the spigot, carried it to my desk, punched for messages at the computer terminal. A slender file slid from the slot. A hopeful sign. I picked it up, one-handed so I could sip coffee as I went through it, and let it fall open in the middle. Color holographs jumped out at me. I was looking down through a pair of windows over two morgue tables. Stomach to brain. Lurch! What a hell of an hour to be looking at people with their faces burnt off. Get eyes to look somewhere else, and don't try to swallow that coffee. Why don't you change jobs? They were hideous. Two of them, a man and a woman. Something had burnt their faces away down to the skulls and beyond. Bones and teeth charred. Brain tissue cooked. I swallowed and kept looking. I'd seen the dead before. These had just hit me at the wrong time. Not a laser weapon, I thought, though that was chancy. There are thousands of jobs for lasers, and thousands of varieties to do the jobs. Not a hand laser, anyway. The pencil-thin beam of a hand laser would have chewed channels in the flesh. This had been a wide, steady beam of some kind. I flipped back to the beginning and skimmed. Details. They'd been found on the Wilshire Slidewalk in West Los Angeles around 4:30 a.m., People don't use the slidewalks that late. They're afraid of organ leggers. The bodies could have traveled up to a couple miles before anyone saw them. Preliminary autopsy. They'd been dead 3 or 4 days. No signs of drugs or poisons or puncture marks. Apparently the burns had been the only cause of death. It must have been quick then, a single flash of energy. Otherwise they'd have tried to dodge and there'd be burns elsewhere. There were none, just the faces and char marks around the collars. There was a memo from Bates, the coroner. From the looks of them, they might have been killed by some new weapon, so he'd sent the file over to us. Could we find anything in the Arm files that would fire a blast of heat or light a foot across? I sat back and stared into the hollows and thought about it. A light weapon with a beam a foot across? They make lasers that size, but as war weapons, used from orbit. One of those would have vaporized the heads, not charred them. There were other possibilities. Death by torture, with the heads held in clamps in the blast from a commercial attitude jet. Or some kind of weird industrial accident, a flash explosion that had caught them both looking over a desk or something. Or even a laser beam reflected from a convex mirror. Forget about its being an accident. The way the bodies were abandoned reeked of guilt, of something to be covered up. Maybe Bates was right, a new illegal weapon. And I could be deeply involved in searching for it when the mother hunt started. The Arm has three functions. We hunt organ leggers. We monitor world technology, new developments that might create new weapons, or that might affect the world economy or the balance of power among nations. And we enforce the fertility laws. Come, let's be honest with ourselves. Of the three, protecting the fertility laws is probably the most important. Organ leggers don't aggravate the population problem. Monitoring of technology is necessary enough, but it may have happened too late. There are enough fusion power plants and fusion rocket motors and fusion crematoria and fusion seawater distilleries around to let any madman or group thereof blow up the earth or any selected part of it. But if a lot of people in one region started having illegal babies, the rest of the world would scream. Some nations might even get mad enough to abandon population control. Then what? We've got 18 billion people on earth now. We couldn't handle more. So the mother hunts are necessary, but I hate them. It's no fun hunting down some poor sick woman so desperate to have children that she'll go through hell to avoid her 6-month contraceptive shots. I'll get out of it if I can. I did some obvious things. I sent a note to Bates at the coroner's office. Send all further details on the autopsies, and let me know if the corpses are identified. Retinal prints and brainwave patterns were obviously out, but they might get something on gene patterns and fingerprints. I spent some time wondering where the two bodies had been kept for 3 or 4 days, and why, before being abandoned in a way that could have been used 3 days earlier. But that was a problem for the LAPD detectives. Our concern was with the weapon. So I started writing a search pattern for the computer. Find me a widget that will fire a beam of a given description. From the pattern of penetration into skin and bone and brain tissue, there was probably a way to express the frequency of the light as a function of the duration of the blast, but I didn't fool with that. I'd pay for my laziness later, when the computer handed me a foot-thick list of light-emitting machinery and I had to wade through it. I had punched in the instructions and was relaxing with more coffee and a cigarette when Ordaz called. Detective Inspector Julio Ordaz was a slender, dark-skinned man with straight black hair and soft black eyes. The first time I saw him in a phone screen, he'd been telling me of a good friend's murder. 2 years later, I still flinched when I saw him. Hello, Julio. Business or pleasure? Business, Gil. It is to be regretted. Yours or mine? Both. There's a murder involved, but there's also a machine. Look, can you see it behind me? Ordaz stepped out of the field of view and then reached invisibly to turn the phone camera. I looked into somebody's living room. There was a wide circle of discoloration in the green indoor grass rug. In the center of the circle, a machine and a man's body. Was Julio putting me on? The body was old, half mummified. The machine was big and cryptic in shape, and it glowed with a subdued, eerie blue light. Ordaz sounded serious enough. Have you ever seen anything like this? No, that's some machine. Unmistakably an experimental device. No neat plastic case, no compactness, no assembly line welding. Too complex to examine through a phone camera, I decided. Yeah, that looks like something for us. Can you send it over? Ordaz came back on. He was smiling, barely. I'm afraid we cannot do that. Perhaps you should send someone here to look at it. Where are you now? In Raymond Sinclair's apartment on the top floor of the Roadwall building in Santa Monica. I'll come myself, I said. My tongue suddenly felt thick. Please land on the roof. We are holding the elevator for examination. Sure. I hung up. Raymond Sinclair. I'd never met Raymond Sinclair. He was something of a recluse. But the arm had dealt with him once in connection with one of his inventions, the Firestop device. And everyone knew that he'd been lately working on an interstellar drive. It was only a rumor, of course. But if someone had killed the brain that held that secret... I went. The Roadwall building was 40 stories of triangular prism with a row of triangular balconies going up each side. The balconies stopped at the 38th floor. The roof was a garden. There were rose bushes in bloom along one edge, full-grown elms nestled in ivy along another, and a miniature forest of bonsai trees along the third. The landing pad and carport were in the center. A squad car was floating down ahead of my taxi. It landed and then slid under the carport to give me room to land. A cop in vivid orange uniform came out to watch me come down. I couldn't tell what he was carrying until I had stepped out. It was a deep-sea fishing pole, still in its kit. He said, "May I see some ID, please?" I had my arm ident in my hand. He checked it in the console in the squad car and then handed it back. "The inspector's waiting downstairs," he said. "What's the pole for?" He smiled suddenly, almost secretively. "You'll see." We left the garden smells via a flight of concrete stairs. They led down into a small room half full of gardening tools and a heavy door with a spy eye in it. Ordaz opened the door for us. He shook my hand briskly, glanced at the cop. "You found something? Good." The cop said, "There's a sporting goods store 6 blocks from here. The manager let me borrow it. He made sure I knew the name of the store." "Yes, there will certainly be publicity on this matter." "Come, Gil." Ordaz took my arm. "You should examine this before we turn it off." No garden smells here, but there was something, a whiff of something long dead that the air conditioning hadn't quite cleared away. Ordaz walked me into the living room. It looked like somebody's idea of a practical joke. The indoor grass covered Sinclair's living room floor, wall to wall. In a perfect 14-foot circle between the sofa and the fireplace, the rug was brown and dead. Elsewhere it was green and thriving. A man's mummy, dressed in stained slacks and turtleneck, lay on its back in the center of the circle. At a guess, it had been about 6 months dead. It wore a big wristwatch with extra dials on the face and a fine mesh platinum band, loose now around a wrist of bones and brown skin. The back of the skull had been smashed open, possibly by the classic blunt instrument lying next to it. If the fireplace was false, it almost had to be. Nobody burns wood. The fireplace instruments were genuine 19th or 20th century antiques. The rack was missing a poker. A poker lay inside the circle, in the dead grass next to the disintegrating mummy. The glowing Goldberg device just sat in the center of the magic circle. I stepped forward, and a man's voice spoke sharply. "Don't go inside that circle of rug. It's more dangerous than it looks." It was a man I knew, Officer 1 Valpredo, a tall man with a small straight mouth and a long, narrow Italian face. "Looks dangerous enough to me," I said. "It is. I reached in there myself," Valpredo told me, "right after we got here. I thought I could flip the switch off. My whole arm went numb, instantly. No feeling at all. I yanked it away fast, but for a minute or so after that, my whole arm was dead meat. I thought I'd lost it. Then it was all pins and needles, like I'd slept on it." The cop who had brought me in had almost finished assembling the deep-sea fishing pole. Ordaz waved into the circle. "Well, have you ever seen anything like this?" I shook my head, studying the violet glowing machine. "Whatever it is, it's brand new. Sinclair's really done it this time." An uneven line of solenoids was attached to a plastic frame with homemade joins. Blistered spots on the plastic showed where other objects had been attached and later removed. A breadboard bore masses of heavy wiring. There were 6 big batteries hooked in parallel and a strange heavy piece of sculpture in what we later discovered was pure silver, with wiring attached at 3 curving points. The silver was tarnished almost black, and there were old file marks at the edges. Near the center of the arrangement, just in front of the silver sculpture, were 2 concentric solenoids embedded in a block of clear plastic. They glowed blue, shading to violet. So did the batteries. A less perceptible violet glow radiated from everywhere on the machine, more intensely in the interior parts. That glow bothered me more than anything else. It was too theatrical. It was like something a special effects man might add to a cheap late-night thriller to suggest a mad scientist's laboratory. I moved around to get a closer look at the dead man's watch. "Keep your head out of the field," Valpredo said sharply. I nodded. I squatted on my heels outside the borderline of dead grass. The dead man's watch was going like crazy. The minute hand was circling the dial every 7 seconds or so. I couldn't find the second hand at all. I backed away from the arc of dead grass and stood up. Interstellar drive hell. This blue-glowing monstrosity looked more like a time machine gone wrong. I studied the single throw switch welded to the plastic frame next to the batteries. A length of nylon line dangled from the horizontal handle. It looked like someone had tugged the switch on from outside the field by using that line, but he'd had to hang from the ceiling to tug it off that way. I see why you couldn't send it over to ARM headquarters. You couldn't even touch it. You stick your arm or your head in there for a second, and that's 10 minutes without a blood supply. Ordaz said, "Exactly. It looks like you could reach in there with a stick and flip that switch off. Perhaps. We're about to try that." He waved at the man with the fishing pole. There was nothing in this room long enough to reach the switch. We had to send. "Wait a minute, there's a problem." He looked at me. So did the cop with the fishing pole. That switch could be a self-destruct. Sinclair was supposed to be a secretive bastard. Or the field might hold considerable potential energy. Something might go bluey. Ordaz sighed. "We must risk it, Gil. We have measured the rotation of the dead man's wristwatch. 1 hour per 7 seconds. Fingerprints, footprints, laundry marks, residual body odor, stray eyelashes, all disappearing at 1 hour per 7 seconds. He gestured, and the cop moved in and began trying to hook the switch. "Already we may never know just when he was killed," said Ordaz. The tip of the pole wobbled in large circles, steadied beneath the switch, made contact. I held my breath. The pole bowed. The switch snapped up, and suddenly the violet glow was gone. Valpredo reached into the field, warily, as if the air might be red hot. Nothing happened, and he relaxed. Then Ordaz began giving orders, and quite a lot happened. 2 men in lab coats drew a chalk outline around the mummy and the poker. They moved the mummy onto a stretcher, put the poker in a plastic bag, and put it next to the mummy. I said, "Have you identified that?" "I'm afraid so," said Ordaz. Raymond Sinclair had his own autodoc. "Did he? Those things are expensive." "Yes, Raymond Sinclair was a wealthy man. He owns the top 2 floors of this building and the roof." According to the records in his doc, he had a new set of bud teeth implanted 2 months ago. Ordaz pointed to his mummy, to the skin-back, dry lips, and the buds of new teeth that were just coming in. Right. That was Sinclair. That brain had made miracles, and somebody had smashed it with a wrought iron rod. The interstellar drive? That glowing Goldberg device? Or had it been still inside his head? I said, we'll have to get whoever did it. We'll have to. Even so, no more miracles. We may have her already. I looked at him. There's a girl in the autodoc. We think she's Dr. Sinclair's great-niece, Janice Sinclair. It was a standard drugstore autodoc, a thing like a giant coffin with walls a foot thick and a headboard covered with dials and red and green lights. The girl lay face up, her face calm, her breathing shallow. Sleeping Beauty. Her arms were in the guts of the dock, hidden by the bulky, rubbery sleeves. She was lovely enough to stop my breath. Soft brown hair showed around the electrode cap, small perfect nose and mouth, smooth pale blue skin shot with silver threads. That last was an evening dye job. Without it, the impact of her would have been much lessened. The blue shade varied slightly to emphasize the shape of her body and the curve of her cheekbones. The silver lines varied too, being denser in certain areas, guiding the eye in certain directions, to the tips of her breasts, or across the slight swell of abdominal muscle to a lovely oval navel. She'd paid high for that dye job, but she would be beautiful without it. Some of the headboard lights were red. I punched for a readout and was jolted. The doc had been forced to amputate her right arm, gangrene. She was in for a hell of a shock when she woke up. All right, I said, she's lost her arm. That doesn't make her a killer. Ordaz asked, if she were homely, would it help? I laughed. You'd question my dispassionate judgment? Men have died for less. Even so, I thought he could be right. There was good reason to think that the killer was now missing an arm. What do you think happened here, Gil? Well, any way you look at it, the killer had to want to take Sinclair's, time machine with him. It's priceless, for one thing. For another, it looks like he tried to set it up as an alibi, which means that he knew about it before he came here. I'd been thinking this through. Say he made sure some people knew where he was a few hours before he got here. He killed Sinclair within the range of the, call it a generator, turned it on. He figured Sinclair's own watch would tell him how much time he was gaining. Afterward, he could set the watch back and leave it with the generator. There'd be no way the police could tell he wasn't killed 6 hours earlier or any number you like. Yes, but he could not do that. There was that line hanging from the switch. He must have turned it on from outside the field, probably because he didn't want to sit with the body for 6 hours. If he tried to step outside the field after he turned it on, he'd bump his nose. It'd be like trying to walk through a wall, going from field time to normal time. So he turned it off, stepped out of range, and used that nylon line to turn it on again. He probably made the same mistake Valpredo did. He thought he could step back in and turn it off. Ordaz nodded in satisfaction. Exactly. It was very important for him, or her, to do that. Otherwise, he would have no alibi and no profit. If he continued to try to reach into the field... Yeah, he could lose the arm to gangrene. That'd be convenient for us, wouldn't it? He'd be easy to find. But look, Julio, the girl could have done the same thing to herself trying to help Sinclair. He might have been not have been that obviously dead when she got home. He might even have been alive, Ordaz pointed out. I shrugged. In point of fact, she came home at 1:10 in her own car, which is still in the carport. There are cameras mounted to cover the landing pad and carport. Dr. Sinclair's security was thorough. This girl was the only arrival last night. There were no departures. From the roof, you mean. Gil, there are only two ways to leave these apartments. One is from the roof, and the other is by elevator, from the lobby. The elevator is on this floor, and it was turned off. It was that way when we arrived. There is no way to override that control from elsewhere in this building. So someone could have taken it up here and turned it off afterward. Or Sinclair could have turned it off before he was killed. I see what you mean. Either way, the killer has to still be here. I thought about that. I didn't like its taste. No, it doesn't fit. How could she be bright enough to work out that alibi and then dumb enough to lock herself in with the body? Ordaz shrugged. She locked the elevator before killing her uncle. She did not want to be interrupted. Surely that was sensible. After she hurt her arm, she must have been in a great hurry to reach the dock. One of the red lights turned green. I was glad for that. She didn't look like a killer. I said, half to myself, "Nobody looks like a killer when he's asleep." "No, but she is where a killer ought to be. Que latissima." We went back to the living room. I called ARM headquarters and had them send a truck. The machine hadn't been touched. While we waited, I borrowed a camera from Valparaiso and took pictures of the setup in situ. Relative positions of the components might be important. The lab men were in the brown grass using aerosol sprays to turn fingerprints white and give a vivid yellow glow to faint traces of blood. They got plenty of fingerprints on the machine, none at all on the poker. There was a puddle of yellow in the grass where the mummy's head had been, and a long yellow snail track ending at the business end of the poker. It looked like someone had tried to drag the poker out of the field after it had fallen. Sinclair's apartments were roomy and comfortable and occupied the entire top floor. The lower floor was the laboratory where Sinclair had produced his miracles. I went through it with Valparaiso. It wasn't that impressive. It looked like an expensive hobby setup. These tools would assemble components already fabricated, but they would not build anything complex. Except for the computer terminal. That was like a little womb with a recline chair inside a 360-degree wraparound holovision screen and enough bank controls to fly the damn thing to Alpha Centaurus. The secrets there must be in that computer, but I didn't try to use it. We'd have to send an ARM programmer to break whatever fail-safe code Sinclair had put in the memory banks. The truck arrived. We dragged Sinclair's legacy up the stairs to the roof in one piece. The parts were sturdily mounted on their frame, and the stairs were wide and not too steep. I rode home in the back of the truck, studying the generator. That massive piece of silver had something of the look of bird in flight, a triangle operated on by a topology student with wires that were what were still the corners. I wondered if it was the heart of the machine or just a piece of misdirection. Was I really riding with an interstellar drive? Sinclair could have started that rumor himself to cover whatever this was. Or there was a law against his working two projects simultaneously. I was looking forward to Barra's reaction. Jackson Barra came upon us moving it through the halls of ARM headquarters. He trailed along behind us, nonchalant. We pulled the machine into the main laboratory and started checking against the hollows I'd taken, in case something had jarred loose. Barra leaned against the door jamb, watching us, his eyes gradually losing interest until he seemed about to go to sleep. I'd met him 3 years ago, when I'd returned from the asteroids and joined the ARM. He'd been 20 then, and 2 years in ARM. But his father and grandfather had both been ARMs. Much of my training had come from Barra. As I learned to hunt men who hunted other men, I had watched what it was doing to him. An ARM needs empathy. He needs the ability to piece together a picture of the mind of his prey. But Barra had too much empathy. I remember his reaction when Kenneth Graham killed himself. A single surge of current through the plug in his skull and down the wire to the pleasure center of his brain. Barra had been twitchy for weeks. In the Anubis case last year, when we realized what the man had done, Barra had been close to killing him on the spot. I wouldn't have blamed him. Last year, Barra had had enough. He'd gone into the technical end of business. His days of hunting Ortenleggers were finished. He was now running the ARM laboratory. He had to want to know what this oddball contraption was. I kept waiting for him to ask, and he watched, faintly smiling. Finally, it dawned on me. He thought it was a practical joke, something I'd cobbled together for his own discomfiture. I said, "Barra," and he looked at me brightly and said, "Hey, man, what is it?" "You ask the most embarrassing questions." "Right, I can understand you're feeling that way, but what is it? I love it, it's neat, but what is this thing you've brought me?" I told him all I knew, such as it was. "When I finished," he said, "it doesn't sound much like a new space drive." "Oh-ho, you heard that too, did you?" "No, it doesn't. Unless..." I'd been wondering since I first saw it. "Maybe it's supposed to accelerate a fusion explosion. You'd get greater efficiency in a fusion drive." "Nope, they get better than 90% now, and that widget looks heavy." He reached to touch the bent silver triangle, gently, with long tapering fingers. "Huh. Well, we'll dig out the answers. Good luck. I'm going back to Sinclair's place." "Why, the action is here." Often enough he'd heard me talking wistfully about joining an interstellar colony. He must know how I'd feel about a better drive from the interstellar slowboats. "It's like this," I said. "We've got the generator, but we don't know anything about it. We might wreck it." I'm going to have a whack at finding someone who knows something about Sinclair's generator. Meaning? Whoever tried to steal it, Sinclair's killer. If you say so. But he looked dubious. He knew me too well. He said, I understand there's a mother hunt in the offing. Oh? He smiled, just a rumor. You guys are lucky. When my dad first joined, the business of the arm was mostly mother hunts. The organleggers hadn't really gotten organized yet, and the fertility laws were new. If we hadn't enforced them, nobody would have obeyed them at all. Sure, and people threw rocks at your father. Barra, those days are gone. They could come back. Having children is basic. Barra, I did not join the arm to hunt unlicensed parents. I waved and left before he could answer. I could do without the call of duty from Barra, who had done with hunting men and mothers. I had a good view of the road-walled building dropping toward the roof this morning. I had a good view now from my commandeered taxi. This time I was looking for escape paths. There were no balconies on Sinclair's floors, and the windows were flush to the side of the building. A cat burglar would have trouble with them. They didn't look like they'd open. I tried to spot the cameras Ordaz had mentioned as the taxi dropped toward the roof. I couldn't find them. Maybe they were mounted in the elms. Why was I bothering? I hadn't joined the arm to chase mothers or machinery or common murders. I'd joined to pay for my new arm. My new arm had reached the World Organ Bank via a captured organlegger's cache. Some honest citizen had died unwillingly on a city slidewalk, and now his arm was part of me. I'd joined the arm to hunt organleggers. The arm doesn't deal in murder per se. The machine was out of my hands now. A murder investigation wouldn't keep me out of a mother hunt, and I'd never met the girl. I knew nothing of her beyond the fact that she was where a killer ought to be. Was it just that she was pretty? Poor Janice, when she woke up. For a solid month, I'd waken to that same stunning shock, the knowledge that my right arm was gone. The taxi settled. Valfredo was waiting below. I speculated. Cars weren't the only things that flew, but anyone flying one of those tricky ducted fan fly cycles over a city, where he could fall on a pedestrian, wouldn't have to worry about a murder charge. They'd feed him to the organ banks regardless. And anything that flew would have to have left traces anywhere but on the landing pad itself. It would crush a rosebush or a bonsai tree, or be flipped over by an elm. The taxi took off in a whisper of air. Valpredo was grinning at me. The thinker, what's on your mind? I was wondering if the killer could have come down on the carport roof. He turned to study the situation. There are two cameras mounted on the edge of the roof. If his vehicle was light enough, sure he could land there, and the cameras wouldn't spot him. Roof wouldn't hold a car, though. Anyway, nobody did it. How do you know? I'll show you. By the way, we inspected the camera system. We're pretty sure the cameras weren't tampered with. And nobody came down from the roof last night except the girl? Nobody. Nobody even landed here until 7 this morning. Look here. We had reached the concrete stairs that led down into Sinclair's apartments. Valpredo pointed at a glint of light on the sloping ceiling, at heart level. This is the only way down. The camera would get anyone coming in or out. It might not catch his face, but it'd show if someone had passed. It takes 60 frames a minute. I went on down. A cop let me in. You've been listening to Arm, from The Long Arm of Gail Hamilton by Larry Niven. This story has been broadcast with the kind permission of Mr. Niven and Delray Books. Our reader tonight was Gary Hanrahan. Short Happy Life is produced by Gary Hanrahan and was recorded by Heather Slade. Join us again next Monday at 5:30 p.m. for Short Happy Life.